This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Welcome to the TriDot Podcast. It is simple. The triathlon race course has rules for us to follow, and thus it needs folks in place to enforce those rules. The rules are there for safety, and they are there for fairness, and the officials are there to help make sure we all have a great day out there on the race course. And today on the podcast, we'll learn all about race officiating from two USA Triathlon race officials. Our first guest is Mark Turner, who serves as the Commissioner of Officials for USA Triathlon. The second is TriDot Ambassador Tim Farwig, who is part of the USA Triathlon Officials Leadership Team. Both of these gentlemen are experienced race officials, and of course, they are triathletes themselves. Mark, Tim, thanks so much for joining us on the TriDot Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having us. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Andrew, for inviting us to be a part of this today.
Now, she isn't on the podcast today, but I do want to give a shout out to Tina Stewart. Tina is a TriDot ambassador. She is the lead triathlon coach for Team Playmakers based in Michigan State, and she is a USAT race official herself. So shout out to Tina, wherever you are listening today. And Tim, I also wanted to give you just a public thank you very quickly. You are a longtime listener of the podcast, and you sent me a custom Captain of the Middle of the Pack t-shirt. And little did you know that shortly after you sent it to me, I would lose all of my TriDot shirts in a luggage fiasco with Hawaiian Airlines. And that shirt, Tim, was the only shirt I had for a while with a TriDot logo on it. So I wore it through a lot of training sessions and even on race day at Clash Daytona a few years ago. So Tim, thanks so much for that shirt. It came in handy.
Well, I appreciate the shout out. We were in the middle of making some shirts and I thought, you know, it'd be fun and kind of fun to make something for Andrew, not expecting him to wear it, especially seeing him come down pit lane at Daytona wearing it. I'm a firm member of that rank and file of the middle of the pack. So I thought it was definitely something you needed.
I sure did. I am Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set conversation talking about race officiating, and then wind things down with our cool down. Lots of good stuff. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
There are so many triathlon events worldwide that they can be located in all sorts of places. You know, some are in small towns, some are in big cities, some are along the coast, some are near mountains, some are out in the desert. The variety to triathlon race sites is endless. And that brings us to our warm-up question today. What race location is your favorite to visit? Now, I'm not basing this on the race itself, the race site, the race course, anything like that. I'm talking about the town or the city hosting the race. So, Tim, Mark, what is your favorite location you've ever been to? I know in your positions as race officials, you've had the chance to travel to far more races than the average triathlete. So I'm excited to see what you both have to say. Tim, what is this answer for you?
Well, again, we get a lot of opportunities to go to a lot of interesting and great places, but I'm a Midwestern born and raised kid. And quite honestly, this might surprise some people. Milwaukee is quite honestly my favorite place to go.
Wow.
It's been the host of nationals the last few years. So not only have I raced it, but last year was probably one of the biggest undertakings USAT had in Milwaukee. And it was just the perfect place for all the events we had. And so by far, that's my favorite place.
Oh, very interesting. And I remember when USA Triathlon put Age Group Nationals there, I was kind of like, really, Milwaukee? And then I all of a sudden, like the first event happened, and I started seeing athletes post pictures on Instagram. I started seeing video clips go out from USAT, and it was like, oh my gosh, is Milwaukee beautiful? Like, is Milwaukee gorgeous? Like, right there on the waterfront, like, it looks like a super great event. So very, very interesting for you to pick that. Mark, what is this answer for you? Is it also Milwaukee?
Well, I do love Milwaukee, but as you could imagine, as we've already mentioned first, we go to a lot of places. I've been to a lot of race sites. Each one has its own kind of uniqueness. And once again, while I really favor Milwaukee, I'm also looking forward to us going to Omaha this year.
Okay.
The other thing that I would say is if I'm really picking my favorite race site, it would be Sylvan Beach. Little sprint triathlon. It's about 10 minutes from my
house. I've heard of it. Yeah.
So you can start to understand why that would be a favorite for somebody who travels a lot.
You can't beat that, Mark. You can't beat the race location, just walking out of your house and walking to T1, right? Like that's the dream for all of us, really. So my answer here, I honestly, I would have to say Greece or New Zealand. I've raced internationally in Greece and New Zealand. And I feel like it's kind of cheating though, because anytime you travel international, it's just extra cool. So of course I'm going to pick those places because those trips were extra cool, but I love those race sites. So we're going to post this question to our audience. Make sure you're a part of the I Am Trout Facebook group. Every Monday when the new show comes out, I pose the warm-up question to you, our audience. So find the post asking you, where in the world is your favorite race city, your favorite host city for a race? Can't wait to see what you have to say.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
Before we get too deep into the show today, I want to give a shout out to our good friends at UCAN. Here at TriDot, we are huge believers in using UCAN to fuel our training and racing. In the crowded field of nutrition companies, what separates UCAN from the pack is the science behind Live Steady, the key ingredient in UCAN products. While most energy powders are filled with sugar or stimulants that cause a spike and crash, UCAN energy powders, powered by Live Steady, deliver a steady release of complex carbs to give you stable blood sugar and provide long-lasting energy. I personally fuel my workouts with the orange-flavored Edge gel and the unflavored UCAN energy powder. Between their energy mix, energy bars, almond butter, and more, there is definitely a Live Steady product that you will love. So head to their website, ucan.co, and use the code TRIDOT to save 20% on your entire order. Now that code used to be 10%, but the fine folks at UCAN have upped it to 20% for TRIDOT Nation. So once again, that's ucan.co, promo code TRIDOT. All right, very excited to have Mark and Tim just tell us everything they can about the experience, what it's like for them to be a race official, how they got into that position in the first place, and for us as triathletes to learn how to have a great race out there, how to have a safe race, how to have a infraction-free race, most importantly. Lots of good stuff to dive into with our USA Triathlon race officials. And guys, we're going to spend a good 30 minutes or so here in the trenches with the two of you learning about these things. But first, I want to give you each a chance to talk as triathletes. You both train and race yourselves. Tim, we were just talking before we started recording. You have half Ironman Gulf Coast coming up, 70.3 Gulf Coast in Panama City Beach, Florida, in just a few months. From all of your racing, not the officiating, just your racing, what is your favorite race day to talk about? Mark, what is this for you?
For me, I would definitely say it was my first triathlon. Took place over in Louisiana, in a dedicated lake, you know, the mental image one has of a dedicated lake, in Southern Louisiana is not necessarily appealing at first glance. However, this was a private lake and the owner poured dump trucks loads of limestone into it every year because it was built intentionally for his children to water ski.
Oh, wow.
So it was a fairly man-made lake. I was very anxious. I wanted to make sure I got into the race. It was limited to 300 people. And it was going to take place in early March, late February. And it can be a little cool country, even in the South. And so I was like hovering. I signed up for the race immediately and I got in, got the notification. Packet pickup was on race morning. And when I arrived, I found out that it was going to be a time trial start and they had arranged time trial start based on who signed up first versus who signed up last. I found out that I was number one.
That's amazing.
And my first triathlon. And I was lined up on the beach and people were jumping in and jumping out because the water was very cold.
And this is your first triathlon ever, right? You're the first one in the water.
I'm the first one in the water, and I'm also acutely aware at this point that I'm getting ready to have 299 people swim over top of me. So I was trying to see how far could I go before I started really getting slammed with, because it was definitely a wetsuit swim. My face went into the water, didn't go back in the water until I finished the point to point 600 meter swim to the other side. I was running in five fingers in those days. The bike went pretty uneventfully, but I was running in five fingers. And by the time I got off the swim and the bike, my feet were numb. And so I didn't discover until the end of the race that I had two toes in several of the pockets of my five fingers. Were numb, so I couldn't tell. And I placed second place in the beginner category.
Okay, cool.
I was hooked from there.
That is a memorable start to a triathlon journey. That's for sure. I've never heard of a newbie, first timer, having to enter the water first at a race. That's amazing. Tim, what is your favorite race day experience to talk about?
Well, I definitely have a favorite race experience, but I would be remiss if I don't revisit Ironman Florida last year with the TriDot Ambassador Camp, because there were only a few of us that actually raced and were at the camp, but I have never felt so much support from the ambassadors who came out and volunteered and were everywhere on that. I mean, Jeff Boer was on the way into T1. I mean, how many times do you get to see something like that?
Yeah.
Or, Dan Caskey, captain of the T1 and Jeff Rains. And so, I mean, it was an unbelievable experience, capped off with the, I know people have heard the story of the ambassadors racing up and down the run course in golf carts, blasting music and lights and encouraging people. But honestly, my most favorite experience or memorable experience was my first full Ironman at Chattanooga. It was just basically myself and a friend, a training partner. We had no support crew, nobody else. And I wasn't smart enough that my wife was asking a lot of leading questions a month and a half out that made no sense to me, but I wasn't paying attention. And they ended up surprising me the night before and drove all the way down to Chattanooga to be there to support. And then we're actually volunteered at the finish line in the time they felt I was going to finish. And they were there to medal me when I came across. So that's by far my most memorable experience in racing to date.
Yeah, so cool. Yeah, so special to have your race in that way, for sure. We heard from your race stories, we heard, Mark, for you, how you got into racing in the first place. Now I'm curious to know, like, there's hundreds of thousands of triathletes worldwide. Not many of them make the transition to becoming a triathlon official. So how did you even get interested in that position in the first place to become a triathlon official? Mark, what was that journey for you?
Well, so it's really rooted in being official, you know, being an official and in sport, and just obviously there's some hard wiring that I'm interested in. When I participate in an activity, I want to know what the rules are and try to follow them. And so my journey to becoming a triathlon official actually started back in the 90s when I became a golf official.
Okay.
And so my wife and I were both golf officials for a number of years, and we took a break from that. And then we went from that to doing some other things in life. And that's when I started pursuing the multi-sport journey on my own. And as I progressed from running to multi-sport, it became, I was under the rules. You couldn't have somebody handing you bottles of water and things like that on the course. So I lost my Sherpa, and
your Sherpa just had less to do at that point. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. And so we met a rules official over in Louisiana, and he began talking to my wife about becoming a rules official. She did. I began pursuing certification as a coach in endurance sports. And one of the things you can do is you can acquire some CEUs if you go through the officials training. And so she was recertifying, and I decided I would go ahead and certify. Now, it must be clearly understood that when my wife said that she was going to become a rules official, I was very firm in saying that, unlike when I played golf and then started working as a golf official, which reduces the amount of time you have to play
naturally,
golf,
yeah,
I was adamant that I would not become a triathlon official at all. And apparently you can see how well that
worked out very well for you. Yeah.
It didn't work out for me. But for me, race morning when you're an official is a special time. Some of it's selfish, right? Because selfishly, I know I'm enjoying the whole vibe of the morning and everything, and I'm not going to have to race.
Oh, it's the best. Yeah, it's the best. It's the best to be there.
I've got the music. Yeah. I've got, you know, talk interaction with the athletes, everything
the endorphins, the snacks, the coffee, everything. Yeah.
And then the community, you know, and that's what really draws me in. The community in the multi-sport world is so mutually supportive, encouraging to new people. And that has been the thing that really has built my love for the sport and my interest in being able to do as a rules official, first in the field and in my current role to help move our sport forward and keep it growing.
Yeah. And so Tim, for you, I think you as well were an official in some other sports before becoming a triathlon official. What was that transition like for you?
Yeah, I was back in 2020. I knew that I was only a couple of years left on the officiating career that you mentioned before I was going to retire from it. And I was just getting back into triathlon again and went to the small little thing called Clash in 2020, which I know, Andrew, you're very familiar with.
Been there a few times, yeah.
Yeah. And that was like the first big event that came back with COVID. And I remember walking into transition and there's a gentleman standing there with a black and white striped shirt on and credentials. I'm like, wait a minute, there are officials in triathlon? Because I never had seen officials at our local events, which is all I really raced. And so I thought, well, kind of like Mark, I can't race every weekend, but I love that vibe. I love the morning of a race. It's just, there's something to it. And I just wanted more of that, some of that adrenaline and some of that I knew I was going to be missing after retiring, coming off the field. And so I basically at that point said, all right, let's start looking into this. And here I am today. So it went pretty quick from the time I found out we even had officials.
I think, guys, when athletes think of the race officials, I think they most often picture the crew out on the motor, you know, the motorcycles, policing the bike course, making sure we're not drafting. And I know there's a lot more to being an official than that. So just describe for us what all goes on into officiating a race weekend. You know, what are all the tasks and the positions being taken on by the officiating crew?
Well, I would say it varies greatly depending on the size of the race. Right. Because if it's the small local race that has an official, often that is simply one individual serving as head referee and trying to fill as many of the places as possible. So, for example, if I just use a small local race here where there's going to be one head referee is going to get there early in the morning, go through transition, looking for bar end plugs, bin missing, talking to athletes, asking if they have any questions. Then moving on down to the swim start, where hopefully they'll have an opportunity to give us the brief. It doesn't take very long. It's about 5 minutes. Just outlining what are the expectations? What will the official be looking for? As soon as the swim starts, that head referee working by themselves will move over to the motorcycle, have a brief with the motorcycle about the safety, what we're looking for, how we're going to work together, how we're going to ride the motorcycle, when we're likely to come off the course. Because in many of these small races, it's a sprint or as long as an Olympic. And so then once you're done on the bike course, you move to either a bike where people are coming in off the bike to help officiate, you know, things like, you know, the helmet being still buckled before the athlete walks the bike. And that's just kind of a walkthrough of all the way to the end until the first athletes are starting across the finish line. You would have wanted to liaison with the timer in the morning before the race to talk about finish time so that you can assure that there was no course cutting based on the timing data. And at that point, that's how it works when you're flying solo.
That's a lot. Yeah, right? That's a big day.
So if you're not flying solo and let's say you're working with a crew of four or six, and if it's a very large national race, the assignments of, that take care of all of those different things are spread out through a lot more people because you also have a much bigger field, right? So if you have a field of 2,000 versus 200, you're going to have a larger number of officials. So for example, at 2,000, you might have as many, depending on the race itself or the number of races that stack up over a weekend, as many as 20 plus officials, all with distinct assignments. So for example, having people would stay in transition because transition is simply going to function longer.
Yeah, right? True.
Having officials at the mount dismount line, not necessarily depending on the level of the race for rigorous enforcement, but at least to help the athletes understand what our expectations are with the mount dismount line. Having more people out on the run to monitor for issues on the run, and then also having a bigger crew work in the bike portion so that if you have back-to-back days, like for example at Multisport Festival, you don't really want to have the same four or five people every day out on the motorcycle all day long because you're doing back-to-back races. And so it's a balance then at that point. But each one of those things that the individual official, the head ref who's working solo have to do, when you get to a bigger race, it's just spread out.
Well, no, and it makes sense why, Tim, at your smaller local races, you didn't even notice that there was officiating happening. It took you going to a bigger event to have more crew working for you to even see that. So Tim, I know for a little while, you're not in this post anymore, but for a little while you helped coordinate which officials would be at which races for the southern region of the country for USA Triathlon. Can you talk to us a little bit about how officials get selected for certain races? Is it just you sign up for what races you want to go to, or is there some sort of assigning process?
Well, and every assignment coordinator might do it a little bit differently, but for the most part, a lot of times it's availability. But I'll just to tag on a little bit to what Mark said, a lot of the work by the officials, especially the head referee, starts well before race morning. And that goes all the way back to receiving the assignment as the head official. Or head referee. So basically the way it would work is we'd have our list of sanctioned races at requested officials. We would put that list out and see who is available. You have to take into account expense. How far do they have to travel? Is there hotels provided? And that it's, and then it's experience. I mean, that's what it boils down to. And, you know, and once that race is assigned, it is the job of that head referee then to start coordinating with the race director, which quite honestly is one of the most important relationships prior to race morning, because you're working with them, giving them the support they need. And it's a two-way street. You both need each other. So that's a very vital part of the whole process for the race morning and race day to go very well.
I'm curious from both of you, like what is your favorite race day assignment you've ever had? Like what is just the coolest place you found yourself in this sport based on an assignment you had as an official? Mark, what is it for you?
There's a bunch of them.
I bet.
I've worked age group races. I've worked pro races. The pro race that really comes to mind for me is one that took place in the Woodlands, where one of the pros that's faster had caught up to the two young pros who were leading on the final out on the Hardy Toll Road. And when we turned around and made the turn, that athlete passed the other two and was, because they had, at that point had a tailwind, and that athlete was going about 40 miles an hour. So we didn't even, I stayed with the two to make sure they didn't work together to catch him. That athlete ended up having a mechanical further up, but was able to fix that mechanical and ran back into contention in the race. So it was pretty exciting to kind of follow it along. It always has a pretty strong memory on that particular race.
Tim, is your favorite assignment the Speedway at Clash Daytona, or does something else trump that one?
Well, I think something trumps it only because you're correct. The going around the Speedway on the back of a moto is pretty cool for the first 10 laps, the next 40 to 50. Yeah. You've seen it all, but it is a special experience. And I've logged a lot of miles there and Miami Homestead as well. But my experience is pro related as well. And it's actually when PTO raced in Irving. And I was on the moto for both the male race and the female race. And my assignment was slightly different, which required to me possibly at some point having to interact with athletes at the very back of the race in case they were going to be lapped out. But honestly, and all the pro races that I've had the opportunity to work, the athleticism and what these athletes can do and the way they can push themselves and to be right there watching it. And it's an amazing experience. I mean, in most cases they just fly, you know, if you're standing on the sidelines, you just get to see them whiz by and they're gone. And here we're going. And it's always fun to me to kind of peek over the moto driver's shoulder and go, oh my gosh, we're going that fast. This is unbelievable. So, you know, Irving and then in Milwaukee as well last year, I had the same assignment, but again, just to be around athletes like that in this sport are pretty incredible.
So a pretty crucial question for our athletes listening. We don't want to be the athlete who gets done with our race and then checks the timing system and finds out that we have a 2-minute violation for something somewhere along the way. So the next couple questions are geared towards helping us avoid that fate. And I want to start with this. Mark, what are the most common infractions that triathletes commit on the race course?
Well, I guess let me preface this by pointing out that we no longer add penalty time with USA Triathlon. We've gone to the global standard of notifying the athlete on the course.
Okay.
Now, we might need to still have a discussion with them. I even hesitate to say that drafting is the most common. It's probably the one we look at the most because it's where the most unfair competitive advantage can be gained. If I'm really looking at like on the bike course, what do athletes do that they shouldn't be doing the most? And I'm referencing age group athletes. Sure. Here. Age group athletes ride left when there's room to ride right very regularly.
Yes,
and they do it because of a mistaken idea. They think they don't look like that. Their goal is to not look like they're drafting. And the thing that we always talk with the age group athletes every time we get a chance is that you're not a professional. You are allowed to slipstream. And not only are you allowed to slipstream, we want you to if you're an age group athlete. In other words, what we're saying is we want you to stay right, go all the way up, and make the pass in the allotted amount of time. And age group athletes have a tendency to move left well before they get to whatever the bike lengths of clear space that are required based on the distance of the bike course. But the tendency is to move left well before they should. And then they risk a couple of things. They risk being notified that they're out of position. And, you know, we will warn and amend when possible. So in other words, Tim would drive up next to the athlete. And when we say next, we mean abreast. We don't really mean right
sure.
next to them. Safety is number one, and say, athlete 167, please move right unless you're actively passing. And 99% of the cases, that athlete will go, oh, and move, and not again the rest of the day. And that allows us to proactively approach the bike course in such a way that we can reduce the likelihood that packs will form. It doesn't mean it prevents it, but it does drastically reduce it. The other obvious thing, if you're riding left when there's room to ride right, you could end up forcing a block and making if an athlete is forced into in our case, you know, when we're requiring that you pass left and ride right, if they're forced into a right-hand turn, they're not guilty of an illegal pass. You're guilty of a block and you'd receive notification of a penalty. And so that's why we want to early on in the race for a bike course, we want to establish what our expectations are from the back of the motorcycle with the athletes. But I would say that really is, in my experience, the most common. There are uncommon penalties, probably the most memorable uncommon penalty was a few years back. I got notified that there was an issue in transition and it was an athlete's first race. And, never done a triathlon, so they came prepared to celebrate with a bottle of champagne
cool.
and a six-pack of beer, which they broke in transition, scattering glass everywhere, which required us to move a bunch of the athletes in the dark on concrete, which is why if you bring glass into transition and it's identified, whether you break it or not, the penalty is, unless corrected, is disqualification. And you can't correct it once you break it.
I've never even heard of that. I've never considered it. I've never read it in a rule book guide or an athlete guide. I'm sure it's in there somewhere, but I've never considered bringing glass to be a problem. But I could see why. So the obvious thing here for athletes to avoid any of these kind of penalties or mistakes is to read the athlete guide, right? And I think for the most part, we know there's a lot of rules that are universal, like drafting. You can't draft. You have to have your helmet buckled before you leave transition, dismount lines. There's a lot of things that every single race you do, there are rules that are consistent. But then there's also some nuances where certain races will have certain things that are different. I remember, for example, the first time when I did 70.3 Greece, it was an Ironman event in Greece. And that was the first time I had done a race that had some no passing zones. And so that was the first time reading the athlete guide. I was like, oh, that was a new concept for me, that there's going to be zones on the course where I can't pass other athletes. That particular athlete guide also pointed out, hey, there's some very steep inclines on this course. Honestly, during the uphills, you're going to kind of form into groups. We're not really worried about drafting on those uphills. We're worried about drafting the rest of the race, but on the uphills, don't stretch yourselves out over it. Those are some helpful things that I found out reading that athlete guide that I would not have found out otherwise. The athlete guide is there for a reason. I'm encouraging people to read it. You're going to find out what the rules are. But beyond that particular tip, reading the athlete guide, what other tips do you guys have for triathletes to complete a clean race? What would you say, Tim?
Well, I think, and you know, Ironman is very good about this, but they have several briefings before a race, 70.3 and Foals. And I don't care if you've raced them for 25 years, you need to attend an athlete briefing because, like you said, you might find nuances that are just for that race. You know, you mentioned Greece. There are at least two races here in the States that there's a speed limit on downhills. And so had you not read the athlete guide, had you not attend the briefing, and you raced Pennsylvania last year, there was an 18-mile-per-hour speed limit on a downhill that easily you could have been at 35, 40 miles an
hour. Absolutely.
Had you not. But, and had you done that, you were automatically disqualified because they had a tracking system on the mountain to know if you were going faster than you were supposed to. So I think attending an athlete briefing, you know, Ironman's very good about that. The USAT national events, if there's not an in-person one, there's always going to be one attached to the website that you can, you know, listen to and watch at your own pleasure. But I think that's the biggest thing. We're not sitting here saying you need to download the USAT rule book and memorize it. Use the tools that they're giving to you to just know more about the race.
What I would say is ask your questions before the race begins. And the only way that you can know what questions to ask for clarification is if you have attended rules briefing, whether it's virtual or in person, and read the athlete guide for that race. If you don't attend the briefing, whether it's you're likely to miss any last minute changes that might be required by a number of them. For example, the police department does have a lot to say about the bike course. And so if there's been a last minute change due to something that you would not be aware of unless you attended the briefing or reviewed the virtual briefing or looked at the emails that are being sent out in communications or whatever the interface that race is using to give you the most up-to-date information, then you're likely to fall into peril.
Yeah, no, yeah, great, great, great tip.
And I'll piggyback on to Mark real quick there. Ask your questions to officials and race directors. Don't ask the question to your teammate who's racked right next to you, because again, sometimes the people that have been racing the longest are unfortunately the ones who don't know anything about the rules.
True.
Or they're still racing by rules from 20 years ago. So
yeah, the worst official in our program has a name. That official is named social media official. They very rarely get things correct, and which is why we encourage everyone that if you're looking for rules information, go to the one-stop shop, our multi-sport rules page on the USAT website, and there you will find the most up-to-date rules information. If you're doing Google and you're out there on the web searching, it's hard to tell what you will find that has been published in the past by non-USAT personnel.
That's a great point.
With all well-intentioned, but you can still find a lot of incorrect information. We do the best job that we can when we find these things to try to scrub but we're not in control of the myriad of entities that are trying to lend a quote unquote helping hand to provide you with the latest rules information synopsis. And you end up reading the, you know, incorrect things, and you end up following rules that are either very old or are just not correct.
No matter who you are listening today, whatever race you have coming up, read the rule book, take advantage of the resources that Tim and Mark are talking about. Now, when someone does receive a penalty, and Mark, you mentioned that USAT actually updated this to where you're kind of alerted in the moment that you've received a penalty.
Well, let's be clear. It's not necessarily the moment, right? It's always going to be when and if safe to do so.
Okay.
Now, you're more likely to be in the moment if there's something that's happened during the swim, and that would be handled in T1. On the bike course, you're always going to make the first assessment, you know, that is it safe to get in position to notify the athlete? And that's why a lot of times athletes in an on-course notification system will say, well, I wasn't doing that when you notified me. Well, no, because we couldn't get to you at that time, basically. So you may not find out until a little bit down the road that your behavior was observed, recorded, and you were in violation of the competition rules. And then you're notified using a blue or yellow card system, which is an international system. And it requires the athlete to stop, whether it's on the bike course and it's a penalty area. We emphasize penalty area, not just penalty tent, because some of the smaller races may not have the infrastructure to provide a tent, but they can provide an area.
Yeah.
You know, you can put two orange cones up and put on their penalty area, 8.5 to 10. And there are many ways that you can enforce at the local level that are different from what we would think of as like an Ironman race or a national level race for USA Triathlon. But you're required to stop. If you don't stop, then the penalty is disqualification, and we're not going to add penalty time. And that's usually one of the kinds of things that happens in the post-reality of I didn't stop, and they're being informed that they're disqualified. And there's often, can you just add the penalty time? Well, the on-course notification system doesn't work. It loses its integrity. Okay. The whole point of it is that when you cross the finish line, that's your finish time.
Yeah.
When you're not surprised down the, you know, 2 hour or an hour later to find out that your presumed finish time has actually been increased based on the length of the course, you know, because it was a variable time penalty. And so it's still a variable time penalty, but you serve it on the course, or you may serve a stop start penalty. Warning amend, stop start. There's a myriad of ways that in that system that you can enforce the competition rules where you're the penalty meets the actual infraction. In other words, in our old system, what rule you violated didn't matter. So you could get a drafting penalty for your first penalty and an abandoned equipment where you dropped a wrapper on the bike course, and you would still get a magnitude of penalty time added to your time. Whereas in the system that's international that we now have adopted, you know, drafting is the most penalty time, depending on the length of the race. Everything else is going to be much less because the infractions, the amount of unfair competitive advantage gained is so much less.
Oh, that makes sense. If you drop a wrapper, you're not gaining it. It's a rule that you shouldn't break, right? We want to be tidy on the race course, but you're not gaining an unfair advantage, whereas drafting that. So that totally makes sense. I'm curious, and I know this is probably a question you guys get from triathletes all the time when they find out you're a rules official, but I'm curious, from all of your time on the race course, interacting with athletes, policing the course, like, what is just the wildest thing you've seen someone do, or the wildest thing you've seen happen, the wildest interaction you've had with a triathlete, whatever it is? What is something that stands out as like, man, that was a very unusual moment? Tim, what's this answer for you?
And I don't know if this is the same one Mark would be thinking of, but he and I had this experience together.
Okay.
And I won't get too many details, but
sure.
Needless to say, we had an athlete in a full Ironman race commit. I think we were at nine major infractions, including having a boombox taped to his bike going through transition as he was riding in transition. I think
riding
that was
transition.
Some of the
okay.
riding in transition with the boombox. And we, I think, caught wind of it around the time he was on the bike course or close to the end of the bike course. And Mark had the duty of, as head referee that day, of basically encountering this athlete as he came out of T2 shirtless, another major infraction. And so it was by far the most interesting thing I've ever seen, in a race, as far as that is concerned.
I just hear an athlete having their best life out there, right? Just enjoy the day, you know, well, living it up to the max, right?
Yeah. So I had asked him to go up to the top of the hill where they would begin coming down for the run out. And I was waiting at the bottom and, I stand about 5'10", not really 100% sure, but the gentleman probably was, what would you say, 10, 6, 5, oh, 6, 6.
And not only that, about, and just as wide.
And shirtless. Yeah, wide. And shirtless.
And shirtless, yes.
And so the entire time I could see Tim at the top of the hill going, big. And so the athlete got down to the bottom of the hill and I began talking to him. And the whole time I was like this.
How did he respond to the news that he had so many infractions?
Well, as in most cases, denial. You never tell an athlete that they are disqualified. You say you're subject to disqualification. You may continue to race and you have options at the end. But I did let him know that it was highly likely that it would be a disqualification because of the number of failures to follow the instructions of officials and race management throughout the day.
Okay. All right. Well, he had the time on course that he wanted to have, and he may not have had an official finish time because of it, but good for him, right? Good for him. There has been news. I wanted to ask this while I had you guys on. There's been news over the past year or so of just some different technology that can help race officiating. That the most notable that I think people have heard of is Race Ranger, that was just deployed at Clash Miami for the pro race. What do you guys think of this? Are officials generally excited by new tech like this that could help officiating, or are you skeptical that it can do an effective job?
Yeah, I would think that would be highly variable based on the personality of the official. From my perspective, it's anything that helps is good. And I would say from my perspective, it's too early with some of this technology to even take a skeptical approach or even like head over heels. You know, let's see how this plays out. The one thing I would emphasize is no matter what technology we end up employing in our sport, as innovations continue to increase, the individual judgment of the official on course is irreplaceable because there are so many factors that go into determining whether someone is attempting to gain an unfair competitive advantage. It's rooted in behavior, right? I'm not saying that we're out there mind reading or anything, but we do have a certain level of experience and know what we're looking for, know how we're trying to officiate. And like I say, any tool that is developed and perfected that can help officials do their job in the most equitable and fair way, I think we should encourage those innovations certainly as a national federation and certainly as officials within a program. Now, there are some folks that might be more skeptical, but that's a personal decision.
Yeah, Tim, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, we actually had the opportunity to use that in Milwaukee last year for the PTO, and I believe it was used at PTO in Miami, or T100, sorry, this year. I agree with Mark. It's an added tool in our toolbox as an official out on the bike course specifically. And once you know what those colors are indicating, you use that as a tool. And I know the officials, when we were out there that day, we thought, you know, that looks awful close. Well, that's telling us they're within range or they're out of range. They're right where they're supposed to be. And I think it's a great tool for the athletes themselves because they're looking at it just as much as the official is and using that as their basis. So I have not been skeptical, and I can see it as a valuable tool.
Now, I did want to ask about this, but both of you guys have said things, especially early on, about just how when you're watching a race, you know, when you're an official at a race, you're watching what the athletes are doing, you know, as a triathlete, you can't help but get pulled in by what you're seeing on course. You can't help but root for the athletes, hope they have a great day out there. You know, you guys voice just how much you love being a part of race day without being the one racing yourself. So just talk to me about how you view the athletes from your position as an official and what you feel with the athletes and some sort of athlete-official relationship throughout the day. Tim, what is this for you? How do you feel about it?
Well, I think being an active triathlete right now, you know, I understand that anxiety in transition race morning. You know, we train officials, you know, what to say and what not to say to those athletes, but I truly understand what they're going through, that, you know, and that's helpful. I'm there to advocate for them for a safe and a fair race just as much as all the other officials. But sometimes as somebody who does race, you know, I know what that person at the back of the pack is going through. You know, I can understand intent or what really is not intent at the back of the pack. So I think that just helps my judgment to be a better official and just understanding what the athletes are going through on a race day.
Yep.
I would say two things. One, this is how I close every briefing, whether it's a professional athlete or an age group briefing. And that is, I remind them that we're on their side, that we're out there, we're working for them. We're not policemen. We're there to make sure that the race is fair. And one of the things I emphasize both to athletes and to officials, because officials are human beings too, and they recognize that there are ramifications once a penalty is issued, that it is going to impact that athlete's race. However, what we try to emphasize is that when you issue a penalty that you have given thought to, and you feel confident in making the call, you're not just penalizing the athlete who is in violation, but you're protecting the other athlete.
For anybody listening today who has just found this conversation very interesting, maybe they have some extra room in their life to be more involved in the sport, and maybe they're interested in becoming an official. How do they get started, and what does that process look like?
It's a pretty streamlined now. So we have two pages on our website at USA Triathlon. One is our rules page, which if at the bottom of it will point you to the officiating page, where we have information about becoming an official and information, you know, documents for the officials. And we have those front facing because we want to provide transparency to our constituents. And then at the bottom of that page, it'll say, if you're interested in becoming an official, you send an email to rules@usatriathlon.org. And that's all spelled out, rules@usatriathlon.org. That email will be forwarded to the deputy commissioner and her assistant. They'll set up a time to do an interview. They'll walk them through the process. They'll emphasize a couple of key points right at the beginning of that conversation. We like to lead with this. We can teach you the competition rules. We can teach you the nuts and bolts of being a triathlon official. What we cannot teach you is good character and good judgment. You have to come to the officials program with good character and good judgment. Your judgment will improve if you stay in the program because it'll become experiential.
Oh, yeah.
But if you have an axe to grind, if you have an agenda, and we use this example very clearly, if you're still angry about the draft packs at some race in the past
that
may go with nameless, and you've come to the officials program with the solution that none of us who have been working in this sport as officials have ever really given thought to, which is trying to solve drafting in our sport. But you're absolutely convinced you know the way to fix that. You may not last very long in the program, quite frankly, because there's an agenda coming. And the agenda is not to serve the athletes and the multi-sport community primarily, but rather your own personal agenda. You're not going to be a fit for the USA Triathlon Officials Program. And it's pretty easy to discern that. The vast majority, 99% of the officials in our program are dedicated to the athletes and the race directors who they serve. But our program is made up of human beings, and sometimes some of us are flawed. And if you're flawed sufficiently to not be the right kind of official for our program, we will ask you to find something else to do on your weekends besides officiate.
Tim, what would you say to any athlete who is interested in becoming an official?
Well, again, I think it gives you the opportunity. If you love race mornings, but you can't race every weekend, it gives you an opportunity to be involved in a different way. You know, you listed all the different ways you can be involved. It can be low investment. You can just work local and regional races. If you have greater aspirations of working, you know, larger events, those opportunities will come through the program. But, you know, I wouldn't say it's a way to give back to the sport, but it's another way to be involved. And it's a really great opportunity if that's what you're looking for.
So Tim, last question, and then we're gonna slide into the cool down. Tim, like we said earlier, you have Gulf Coast 70.3 coming up in just a little bit at the time we're recording this podcast episode. When you guys have a race coming up, do you take a peek at who the officials are ahead of time, and do you kind of see them going by in the motorcycles and watch them in action, or do you just kind of tune out and enter athlete mode and not even think about it?
You have a rough idea who might be there depending on what the different situations, whether there's a pro element to the race or not. I know a lot of the head referees for Ironman have put their teams together. So you kind of know, because you might have been asked to work it. So okay. You kind of know who's going to be there. I don't particularly go out and search them. I might see them in transition, say hi to them. I have been passed by so many officials that I know very well on the moto who don't even recognize me.
Sure.
And I don't try to flag them down, because I know what they're doing, and you know, they have a job to do, and it's not a social hour. So I might say hi to them and in transition, but that's pretty much the extent of it.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Well, friends, it's cool down time again, and I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. Today's tip is something I am very excited about because our featured TriDot coach specializes in running, and this is an area that I would love to improve myself. Ken Page is a Boston Marathon finisher who started out as a USA Fit Run coach. He eventually caught the triathlon bug and became certified with Ironman U. Ken loves working with beginner, intermediate, and middle-of-the-pack athletes, and loves helping them reach their goals and the podium. Ken was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and work eventually took him to the Houston area, where he currently resides. Welcome to the cool down, Ken.
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Excellent. I am too. I think I know the real reason that you became interested in triathlon. So you saw people running around in spandex, and you fondly remember another time in your life when this was your outfit of choice. So I think you need to enlighten us a little bit about this time period.
Oh, Lord. It was early on when I was growing up playing tennis. I listened to a lot of music that most folks didn't listen to. But I got really involved with the music, and then I got fascinated with I've got a huge record collection, and then had an opportunity hanging out in bars to start chit chatting with some DJs that would spin records for dance clubs, and got a chance to work behind the booth and spin records on during some of the breaks for the DJs, and that's where it kind of evolved. And then I started working in a nightclub myself and kind of changed my look a little bit as time went on, and really started playing the role in a different way, growing my hair out, wearing different clothes, kind of fitting the part of a disc jockey, and kind of living it in a different way.
I bet people just loved you.
Well, my wife still has an old picture of me with blue spandex pants, red crayon shoes, hair down past my shoulders. I don't know where that picture is, but it seems to come out periodically.
I would really like for you to send me that picture just to make my day a little bit brighter.
Well, I'll see if she knows where it's at. It's in a box with all the pictures, but yeah, and it's not a real good quality picture based on the time frame when it was taken, but it was an old Polaroid.
That's incredible. Now, I imagine that while you're training now, you still hit up some of those playlists that.
Oh God. Yeah. I'm heavy into alternative music right now. So, and I spend a lot of time on the trainer, and the music that I play, certainly gets me through some of those threshold workouts. So
I'm sure. And speaking of training, why don't you share with us your super fabulous run tip?
For me, this is something that I'm kind of sharing the message right now, is getting back to the basics of running and incorporating those run drills that so many athletes tend to skip. They just either crunch for time, don't feel the value in doing them, or they just a variety of reasons. So that's something that I've been sending out in email form and carrying that conversation with the folks on my dashboard that I'm working with, and along with the running club that I facilitate locally on Sunday mornings. So the run drills is something that I kind of grew up doing on the track and believe in to improve running efficiency, and it can also carry over to how fast that you run. Run drills are a great way to improve your running efficiency and speed without actually running. So it loosens up the muscles for an upcoming workout, like certainly thresholds. You definitely need to get the legs warmed up and loosened up through a variety of drills.
Yeah, I think one of the important things about those run drills is sometimes not just going through the motions of completing them. I think there's a really important aspect of being intentional with those run drills and making sure that you have the proper form so that you're getting the full benefit of the purpose of that run drill. And just as an example, I was doing, it's cold, like I'm up in Canada now and it's cold out. So I do my run drills inside before I head outside. And I've been walking around this area in my house, and there's a hallway that I have to go through. And whenever I've done those asymmetric arm swings, I've always just done them like, you know, in a regular fashion. But when I go through this one hallway, I'm like, oh, it actually makes a big difference to be in a hallway to try and not like to actually twist your torso, which is an exaggerated motion of what you're doing while you're running. So it's important to do these run drills and also to be intentional about them. So could you share with us one of the run drills that you think most people have a problem with being intentional with when they're doing these run drills for their warm-up?
You mentioned doing run drills indoors before you go outside, and a great one that's easy to do indoors before you go outside is using a resistance band, putting it around either your knees or your ankles, and doing what I call the crab walk, which you're going sideways. It engages those proper muscle groups, the larger glute muscles, and the muscles that really need to fire off to run properly. Great way to get those muscles engaged, and you can do them indoors, going down a hallway, any part of the house, because you're going sideways, and you're just what I call the monster walk or crab walk, going down and do that down one way and back the other two or three times, where you can really feel those glutes engaging. That great exercise to do before you head out the door, that one with some along with some stretching. And I know with the weather changes and where people live, it's cold outside, you certainly don't feel motivated to do anything out when it's really cold and you're bundled up. So doing it indoors before you go outside is a great way to get those muscles fired up.
Yeah, I think I really like that drill that you just mentioned. It's one that I often forget to do before I head out. So thank you for reminding me about that. But the other thing that I like about that drill is that it because we're running in a forward plane, it's nice to get that lateral movement, to get that lateral warm up, because we're not engaging those muscles necessarily. We have to actually remind ourselves to engage those muscles when we're running.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That sagittal plane movement, a forward movement. You're engaging a different set of muscles, And another thing with the resistance band is just using swinging the one leg out and back in, back and forth, you do both sides. Great workout before a run or even after a run, because sometimes after a 45, 60 minute run, things start to change as your body fatigues. So reinforcing the proper muscle group again afterwards is also a good approach. So reminding those glute muscles through the resistance band again afterwards, also it's a good strength exercise.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.